From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As the American-led occupation of Iraq faces a growing uprising, Israel is considering a new plan to withdraw from its long occupation of the Gaza Strip. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has proposed a unilateral withdrawal from Gaza and part of the West Bank. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about this plan and how it may affect Israel and the Palestinians with James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The New York Times. We'll also talk about lessons the U.S. could learn from Israel's occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. Bennett is currently in Jerusalem, where people are bracing for an attack by Hamas in retaliation against Israel's assassination of its founder and spiritual leader last month. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall. U.S. military officials in Iraq say Marines dropped two bombs on a mosque compound in the Iraqi city of Fallujah today. The officials say the Marines also fired rockets at the wall of the mosque after they came under fire from insurgents who were hiding inside. Army officials say there was no significant damage to the mosque itself. Marine officials say one insurgent was killed, but there's no word on civilian casualties. Witnesses say as many as 40 people were killed, but that could not be confirmed independently. Eric Kneeler of member station KPBS is in Fallujah. He reports the U.S. military says the attack on the mosque was retaliatory.
Marines had been under fire from a mosque complex in the center part of Fallujah. They had received rocket-propelled grenade fire, and in fact, one of these RPGs hit a Humvee, wounding five Marines. It was at that point that Marines also saw dozens of armed men enter the mosque. Upon clearing the area and examining the mosque, Marine officials here say they found hundreds and hundreds of machine gun bullet casings from Russian-made machine guns littering the mosque grounds.
Eric Kneeler of member station KPBS. Iraq's top Shiite cleric, Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, today condemned the way the U.S. is handling the Shiite uprising in Iraq. Sistani called for calm on all sides and an end to the violence. Shiite militiamen loyal to another Shiite cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr, have been fighting U.S.-led forces across Iraq since Sunday. According to a new report by Amnesty International, China carried out nearly two-thirds of the world's known court-ordered executions last year and violated its own law by killing at least one man for a crime committed at the age of 16. NPR's Rob Gifford reports.
According to Amnesty's annual report on capital punishment, China executed at least 726 people last year out of 1,146 executions reported worldwide. The report said that China continues to carry out more judicial executions than the rest of the world combined. Amnesty also said the true number of executions in China is believed to be much higher than reported. China executes convicts for crimes ranging from murder and rape to non-violent offenses such as taking bribes or evading taxes. Amnesty complained that China fails to provide fair trials and noted that torture is routinely used to extract confessions from defendants. The Chinese Foreign Ministry had no immediate comment, but has in the past dismissed Amnesty's reports as groundless. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Beijing.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 84 points at 10,486. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the Labor Department says rising oil prices pushed up the cost of goods and materials bought from overseas last month, but rising import prices were matched by an increase in the prices American companies charge for goods shipped abroad. Steve Beckner of Market News International reports.
Import prices rose 0.9% in March, a bigger-than-expected increase that reflected a 6.1% surge in petroleum prices. Oil prices have risen in 9 of the last 10 months after falling last spring. Compared to a year ago, oil import prices are up less than 2%. Non-oil prices were up just 0.2% last month, considerably less than in prior months. They are up 1% over the past year. Export prices had their biggest jump in 9 years, also a gain of 0.9%. Their cumulative first quarter rise was the biggest since 1988. The fastest price spurt came in exported agricultural products, which rose more than 3%. Over the past 12 months, farm prices have risen nearly 21%. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
Boeing has chosen General Electric and Rolls-Royce to make the engines for its new 787 Dreamliner plane. The deals could be worth $40 billion. The 787 will be designed to save on fuel. Continental Airlines says it's going to eliminate paper tickets by the end of this year. Continental
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the American-led occupation of Iraq faces a growing uprising, Israel is considering a new plan to withdraw from its long occupation of the Gaza Strip. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has proposed a unilateral withdrawal from Gaza and part of the West Bank. We asked the New York Times Jerusalem bureau chief, James Bennett, to explain this plan and what it might mean for Israelis and Palestinians, and to consider if any of Israel's experiences as an occupier might have lessons for the U.S. But first, we're going to talk about reactions to Israel's assassination last month of the founder and spiritual leader of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Bennett has written, "It was a measure of Sheikh Yassin's status as an icon to Palestinians and as a perceived threat to Israelis that his death seemed to hold consequences for every player in the conflict, from the Israelis and Palestinians to the Egyptians and Americans." When I spoke with James Bennett this morning, he told me Israelis are braced for a retaliatory attack. I asked if there are rumors about what that attack might be.
There's constant rumors about this. There have been efforts by Hamas and other groups over the last couple of weeks to carry out some sort of an attack. The Israelis say they have something like 62 warnings of attacks right now. But there's general agreement that Hamas has not tried the kind of major retaliation that they've threatened. There are lots of rumors about what that might amount to, a strike at an Israeli minister, for example, an effort to assassinate a minister, some sort of high-ranking politician, some sort of major suicide bombing. As to why it hasn't happened yet, people have various theories about that. One, that Hamas is simply not able to launch an attack right now because they're under such pressure from Israel and because the military restrictions are so stringent. Another is that Hamas, which is a highly disciplined organization, is simply waiting for the Israeli guard to relax a little bit. There's no point, according to this theory, in wasting a potentially devastating suicide bomber when they don't have much shot at getting through. Another theory is that Hamas is waiting for the meeting that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is supposed to hold with President Bush next week, that would be a particularly devastating time to carry out an attack. And the last theory is that maybe they're waiting for the traditional 40 days of mourning to end before retaliating. We've seen that happen in the past.
What has reaction to the assassination of Sheikh Yassin been in Israel? Was that a controversial move within Israel?
No, it was broadly supported by the Israeli public, overwhelmingly supported. And it was interesting, we've seen this with less dramatic results in past attacks on very prominent Hamas figures, but there was substantial majority, overwhelming support for it. And at the same time, a majority of Israelis said it would result in more terrorist attacks, at least in the short term. So it's interesting. It's broadly supported because Sheikh Yassin was seen by the Israeli public as an arch terrorist, as the kind of living embodiment of Hamas, which is officially bent on Israel's destruction. But there is, I think, still some discomfort within Israel about whether this policy of the targeted killings is ultimately effective or not.
Another question about Sheikh Yassin. He was 66. He was a quadriplegic. He was nearly blind. He's considered the spiritual leader of Hamas. Does that make him a problematic target? Spiritual leader, physically incapable himself. Does that conflict at all with his image of arch terrorist?
Well, I think it was a problem for Israel, and some Israeli military officials acknowledged that the imagery certainly wasn't great. They hit this guy on his way home from dawn prayers, being wheeled home in his wheelchair from the mosque, and they struck him with missiles. We still don't know the source of those missiles, whether it was a helicopter, an airplane, how exactly the strike was contended, which is a lot of very expensive military hardware to use against one disabled old man. But there's no question that Sheikh Yassin was the great motivating, unifying figure in Hamas. He was a founder of the organization. He played a very prominent role as a spokesman for the organization. Israel says that he had a role in actually approving attacks and also inspiring suicide bombers. This is, you're starting to get into squishy territory here, because there's no question that he incited against Israel in that he was a propagandist for Hamas. He was an ideological leader for Hamas. He was regarded in Gaza as a very, very eloquent spokesman for the Hamas cause. So to Israel, he was a tremendous security threat.
Let me ask you a question that the United States is having to face now. When you assassinate a leader of a group that believes in the importance of martyrdom, a group where people regularly blow themselves up as suicide bombers, does the death have a different meaning in that culture? And does assassination reverberate differently?
This is a really tough strategic question for Israel. It's something they're extremely conscious of, and I think it's one reason they didn't act against men like Sheikh Yassin for a long time. It was only last year that they began really to target the so-called political leaders of Hamas, the ideological leaders, as opposed to the operational guys who are out there actually recruiting suicide bombers and strapping the bombs to them. There's a real question as to whether a man like Sheikh Yassin is more dangerous dead or alive. That is, whether his death elevates him into a symbol for a broader kind of movement, makes him more sympathetic. His funeral in Gaza was extraordinary. The day he was killed, it was the largest turnout, at least since Yasser Arafat returned to Gaza 10 years ago, triumphantly. About 100,000 people turned out then, perhaps more than that turned out this time. Obviously, you couldn't draw a sharper contrast between what these two events supposedly represented. The return of Yasser Arafat was at the start of the Oslo peace process that was supposed to usher in a new era of reconciliation between these two peoples. The killing of Sheikh Yassin really represents how deep the divide has become and how difficult it's going to be to bridge it. The funeral, as I say, was the mood of this funeral was far less mournful than you'd expect. There were people crying at the mosque. There were people weeping over Sheikh Yassin. But there was much more of a kind of celebratory atmosphere. And people were comparing it to a birthday, to a wedding celebration, which is a language they tend to use with what they call martyrdom, that essentially it's equivalent to the person's wedding. It's something to be celebrated, not mourned. But speakers were calling it a birthday of a new Arab movement, the birthday for a new Muslim movement.
Ariel Sharon recently said, anyone who kills a Jew or harms an Israeli citizen or sends people to kill Jews is a marked man, period. Does this represent a new policy, is this just a continuation?
This has been stated policy for a very long time, and there have been these sorts of threats have been made many, many times in the past. He was referring in those comments specifically to the leader of Hezbollah, the Lebanese guerrilla group, and also to Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader and the president of the governing Palestinian Authority. Mr. Sharon has threatened Mr. Arafat many times over the last couple of years. What's different about it this time, though, is that he said for the first time that he no longer necessarily felt bound by a pledge he made to President Bush 3 years ago now not to harm Arafat. He said times have changed. Arafat's circumstances have changed. He's no longer getting the red carpet treatment he once was. The world now understands who this guy is. And therefore, he suggested he has a freer hand than he may have had last year.
So is Sharon implying that Arafat might be the target of an assassination?
Definitely.
And what is Arafat doing about that?
He's saying he's not concerned, he's not worried about it, that he only worries about God's judgment, no judgment by somebody like Sharon. That's his public posture. Privately, he's expressed some concern about it, and there is some effort now on the Palestinian side. There's a lot of concern around Arafat about what Hamas might do also.
In what sense?
The concern among some Palestinians is that Hamas might strike at Israel, conduct some sort of really devastating attack in the hope that Israel would retaliate by killing Arafat. There's a very deep rivalry between these factions, between Fatah, the more mainstream, more secular, and dominant faction that Yasser Arafat has led for decades, and Hamas. They've historically had a very uneasy relationship. One Hamas, former Hamas official, who once described to me what he saw as Hamas's strategy, he called it the circle. The notion was that Hamas, above all, doesn't want to be seen as engaging in Palestinian civil conflict, that it always stands above that. It leaves it to the Palestinian Authority, which is dominated by Fatah, to actually carry out any kind of inter-Palestinian violence, which they say it only does as a contractor, as Israel's security contractor, essentially, as an Israeli agent. Rather than striking directly at the Palestinian Authority, what it traditionally did was strike at Israel, which would then strike back at the Palestinian Authority. This was the circle. That's changed in the last year as Israel has begun striking more and more directly at the Hamas infrastructure, at the Hamas ideological leadership. But it still exists.
James Bennett is my guest. He's the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. You know, we were talking about the assassination, the Israeli assassination of the spiritual leader and founder of Hamas, Sheikh Yassin. At the same time that has happened and that Israel is waiting for a likely counter attack, Ariel Sharon is talking about disengaging unilaterally from the Gaza and parts of the West Bank. What does that mean? What is his plan?
Well, the plan is still evolving, and the details are being filled in and still debated. But in its broad contours, the plan is to withdraw soldiers and settlers from the entire Gaza Strip. But now Mr. Sharon is talking about retaining control of Gaza's border with Egypt, for example, control of Gaza's port and control of its airport, even after Israel otherwise withdraws. And he's also talking about withdrawing from four isolated settlements in the northern West Bank. He says he's looking at that because the Americans are asking for some kind of withdrawal from the West Bank as well.
What is his reasoning, as far as you can tell, for this unilateral withdrawal as opposed to doing it through the roadmap, through a negotiated peace plan?
His contention is that the Palestinians have demonstrated they cannot be a partner for peace because of their failure to act decisively against groups like Hamas, that they haven't cracked down on the people responsible for suicide bombings. They haven't put them in jail. They haven't rounded them up. They haven't broken the groups apart. He says they haven't acted against incitement against Israel. These sorts of things they're obligated to do under the roadmap peace plan that President Bush unveiled a year ago. Since they haven't done that, he says, there's no point in negotiating with them, that we can't trust them to live up to their side of the agreement. Therefore, he says, Israel has to act on its own. He argues to draw more secure boundaries than it has now, essentially to hunker down behind them more safely. He also says that if Israel doesn't act now, it risks having to give up more territory down the road in what he says could be an internationally imposed peace plan of some sort that would require a more complete Israeli withdrawal.
I think you've already partly explained this, but could you explain the rationale for pulling out unilaterally when usually if you make a big step for that, you expect the other party to give you something in return?
Mr. Sharon himself is having a great deal of difficulty right now explaining to his own allies exactly why a unilateral move that doesn't carry the kind of concessions from the other side that a bilateral agreement would is actually in Israel's interest. He puts it in the terms I already described to you, that it's simply the least worst alternative that Israel has, that it's the best way to ensure or to better provide for the security of Israelis. Palestinians say that Mr. Sharon is simply trying to avoid giving up more territory, as he would almost certainly have to do in any kind of agreement. They say Israel also didn't abide by its obligations under the Roadmap Peace Plan. It hasn't dismantled dozens of isolated outposts that settlers have set up in the West Bank in the last couple of years, which was its first requirement under the peace initiative. So they're accusing Mr. Sharon of using this unilateral plan as kind of a dodge to avoid getting drawn into a peace process that would force him to make concessions. Now, the truth is that though it is unilateral, there is a negotiation underway here. It's just not a negotiation with the Palestinians. It's a negotiation with the Bush administration. And Mr. Sharon is seeking concessions, if you will, recompense is the word that's being used here in Israel, from the Americans for this move.
Like what?
There's a number of things that he's been seeking from Washington here. And the list has evolved over time as the negotiation has continued, with several visits back and forth between Israeli and American officials. The Israelis have progressively trimmed their requests from the Americans as they heard no or not likely from the administration. But what they've been seeking is essentially at least three major things. One is some sort of American assurance that as a part of any eventual peace deal, if there ever is some sort of serious bilaterally negotiated peace agreement, that Israel would not have to return to its 1967 borders, the borders that existed before the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Mr. Sharon regards those boundaries as completely indefensible as a security proposition. Israel would also like to hold on to three very large blocks of settlements in the West Bank. They say they're not asking to annex that territory. In addition, under pressure from his right, Sharon is looking for some kind of a statement from the Bush White House that, as part of a peace agreement, the Palestinians would not have what's known as a right of return to what is now Israel for the refugees of the 1948 Arab-Israeli War and their descendants. This is a huge issue in the peace process here. It's been a deal breaker in the past. It's a demand by the Palestinians that all these refugees who now number in the millions be able to return, have a right to return here if they choose to, which Israelis overwhelmingly see as a way to beat them through sheer demography when they can't beat them through force of arms. That is, turn Israel's democracy against it and overwhelm Israel's Jewish character. And a third thing that they're looking for is money. The Israelis say they're not asking Washington itself to put up money, but maybe to help arrange some sort of loans, guarantees, grants from the World Bank Israel would like to develop the southern Israel, the Negev Desert, as a possible place for the settlers from Gaza to move.
Ariel Sharon recently said, "We have to get out of Gaza, not to be responsible anymore for what happens there." What is he referring to that he no longer wants to be responsible for?
This has been a theme in Sharon's public comments about the Palestinians for some time now. A great deal of concern that Israel is seen as responsible in the international community's eyes for essentially the care and feeding of the Palestinians, for what will happen to the more than 3 million Palestinians now in Gaza and the West Bank. They're living under occupation. Mr. Sharon has now himself used that term. He used it about a year ago, in fact, although he hasn't used it again since because the response from his right was so negative. But he has said it's bad for Israel to hold them under occupation. It's bad for the Palestinians to be held under occupation. He thinks, at least he argues, that by withdrawing, Israel will essentially free itself of this burden, this public relations burden or this moral burden or this perceived moral burden that's presented by the more than 1 million Palestinians who live in Gaza, whose livelihoods, in a sense, Israel controls because it controls all access to the Gaza Strip. Palestinians can't leave the Gaza Strip. They can't import goods to the Gaza Strip without their passing through Israeli hands first. Now, exactly how this withdrawal would relieve Israel of that burden is a very big question right now, because as Mr. Sharon is now saying, Israel plans to retain control of all those border crossings, or control of the airport, control of the marine port. So whether the world would necessarily see Israel as having walked away from the Gaza Strip and left things totally in the Palestinians' hands or not, I think is very much open to question.
So if Israel does pull out of Gaza, then who runs it? Is it still the Palestinian Authority? Do you think that friction will escalate between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas over leadership?
These are all questions that everybody is trying to work out right now. The Israelis and the Americans are in intense discussions with each other about this, and the Palestinians, who aren't really being talked to in any detail by either the Israelis or the Americans right now, are trying to figure it out for themselves. There have been discussions underway for some time. Interestingly, Sheikh Yassin, before he was killed, had actually been pushing these conversations, and he'd been urging Hamas to begin to take some sort of role in governing the Gaza Strip after a withdrawal. His argument was that with the departure of the Israelis, because this is a unilateral move and not a peace agreement, which Hamas would oppose, but since it's unilateral, therefore Hamas wouldn't feel compromised or contaminated by then playing a role in running whatever sort of arrangement is created in Gaza after the Israelis depart. Nobody knows what this is going to look like. The Palestinians are also expected to get some sort of development money, some enhanced international assistance with the departure of the Israelis. The Egyptians are looking at playing some kind of higher profile role. The Europeans, the Americans may get more involved. Whether the Americans essentially negotiating this agreement, as it were, with Israel will somehow make them turn the Palestinians into wards of the Americans, that is, whether the Americans now are playing some kind of a warden role or a caretaker role for the Palestinians that will involve them more deeply in the Gaza Strip, is another really important question that needs to be sorted out.
James Bennett is the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from TIAA Cref, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with James Bennett, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. We'll consider a couple of parallels between the U.S. occupation of Iraq and the Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip and West Bank. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of the interview I recorded this morning with James Bennett, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. At the same time, the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is proposing a unilateral withdrawal from Gaza and part of the West Bank. Israel is continuing construction of the barrier in the West Bank. Israel describes it as a security fence meant to separate West Bank Palestinians from Israelis. Palestinians see it as a way to lock them in and further restrict their freedom and human rights. You wrote that the barrier has had an unintended effect. It stirred a sustained, bloodless protest movement among Palestinians for the first time in more than 3 years of conflict. Would you describe this new movement?
Well, it's been really interesting. You know, this intifada, this Palestinian uprising, as it's gone forward, has become much more focused on bands, really, of gunmen, militants who are largely confined to the big cities now. As the Israelis have moved in and really retaken control of the entire West Bank, the militants have been concentrated in pockets in big cities like Nablus and Hebron and Jenin. And the villages and towns have largely been on the sidelines for at least 2 years or more than 2 years now. There has been other forms of protest, strikes, things like that. But what's happened is they've started building this barrier is it's begun consuming some of the village land along the boundary between the West Bank and Israel. It's brought these villagers out to protect their own interests, to protect their own land. It's a very, very tangible cost to them of this continuing conflict. And it's also brought Israelis out in sympathy with these Palestinians because they see them as innocents in this conflict. These Israelis see these Palestinians as people who aren't suicide bombers. They aren't involved in the ongoing bloody struggle. They're farmers with olive orchards and fields that are losing some of their land to the construction of this barrier.
At the same time that Sharon is moving toward this unilateral withdrawal, it's possible he will be forced to resign over accusations that he took bribes from a real estate developer. Can you give us a brief explanation about what these accusations are about?
The developer, a guy named David Appel, was indicted earlier this year for giving bribes to Mr. Sharon. He's accused essentially of hiring Ariel Sharon's son, Gilad, for an enormous amount of money, something like $3 million, and then actually paying about $700,000 to him for consulting work on development projects, particularly the development of a resort and casino on a Greek island, which is why this whole scandal is known as the Greek island affair. The accusation is that the money that given to Gilad was actually intended to influence Ariel Sharon, who at that time this began was foreign minister in a previous government, that David Appel was seeking Ariel Sharon's influence in winning the Greek sign-off on this plan.
So how likely is it that Sharon will have to resign over this?
This is one of the huge wild cards, along with the threatened retaliation by Hamas, that's sort of hanging over everybody's heads here right now. And it's all in the hands of one man, Israel's attorney general, a guy named Menachem Mazuz. The state prosecutor for Israel has given a recommendation to Mr. Mazuz that he indict the prime minister. That recommendation was promptly leaked to the press, creating a firestorm around Ariel Sharon. Just at the moment, he's trying to secure Washington's sign-off on his unilateral withdrawal plan, substantially weakening him politically and raising a lot of concern in Washington about whether Ariel Sharon will actually be around to carry this plan out. So it's tremendously complicated and already intricate political dynamic here, where Ariel Sharon had already alienated the right wing, the far right parties that are his natural base, and even some of his traditional supporters within his dominant faction, Likud, which is a right-leaning faction, which has traditionally opposed any withdrawal whatsoever from the occupied territories. It's anathema to them. So having alienated these people and still being regarded suspiciously on the left, that is somewhat isolated politically. And in the middle of this very complex negotiation with Washington, Ariel Sharon suddenly had this new front opened up. Now, cynics in Israel or experienced politicos in Israel, take their pick, saw the unilateral withdrawal plan from the beginning as an effort by Sharon to save his political skin. The argument was that by doing something so bold, so dramatic, and so really seen in the Israeli political context as left-leaning, Sharon was seeking to curry favor with the prosecutors who were largely regarded here as part of the kind of dovish establishment, and convince everybody that it would be a terrible time to indict him and remove him from office because he was engaged in something so important.
So that's like an extra layer of cynicism or skepticism about Sharon's unilateral withdrawal plan, that it might just be totally politically motivated as a way to stay in power.
Yes, although in a sense, what difference does it make if it is? I mean, the fact is that he's now embarked on this effort, and it has already had profound, I think, effect on Israeli political debate, because this leader of Likud, which is a party that's traditionally been devoted to the notion of a greater Israel and opposed, it's still officially opposed to the creation of a Palestinian state. This leader, Ariel Sharon, who more than anybody is responsible for the creation of the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza, who actually designed the settlement plan in Gaza, has now come out and said that the Gaza settlements are not in Israel's interest, that it is in Israel's own interest to withdraw from Gaza. That's a sea change.
Do you ever get the impression that Sharon is questioning his own judgment when he pioneered those settlements, when he led, you know, when he helped create those settlements in the occupied territories?
He says he's not, and that times have changed, and that as a result he has to do the responsible thing and adjust to them, that he feels very personally pained by really growing condemnation from the settlers who feel deeply betrayed by what he's done. Ariel Sharon keeps praising them as heroes and all the rest of it, but basically saying it's time for them to come home. He won't admit that he made a mistake in the past.
So how do those settlers feel, knowing that they're going to be asked to move, and I'm not sure that there is necessarily a place to move them to yet?
Well, they say that they may never be asked to move in the end. Nothing has happened so far. All of this is a very, very difficult policy that has yet to be approved by the Israeli government. It hasn't gotten the backing yet from Washington. So they're kind of, they've waited out other such suggested moves in the past. Nothing by a politician with Sharon's right-wing credentials, but they've waited them out in the past, and they say they'll be able to wait this one out. In the meantime, they say they're going to continue building, moving more people in, improving their homes, building new fences, and also working politically against the prime minister.
James Bennett is my guest. He's the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Bennett. He's the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. Ariel Sharon says that, you know, if there is this unilateral withdrawal from the Gaza and parts of the West Bank, that it would be fully coordinated with the U.S. It seems to me the U.S. is in a strange position now, watching Israel unable to solve the problem of its occupation as the U.S. sinks deeper into the problems it's having in its occupation of Iraq. Now, this month, next week, in fact, Sharon will discuss his unilateral withdrawal plan with President Bush, and I think it's the following week that the Palestinian foreign minister, Nabil Shaath, will meet with Colin Powell and other U.S. officials to discuss the unilateral withdrawal. Can you talk about the odd position that the Bush administration is in now, like the kind of difficulties the Bush administration is facing in figuring out how to respond to Sharon?
Well, they're also obviously facing their own political quandary right now, and a tremendous strategic quandary and immediate military problem in Iraq, which has got to be the focus of the administration's attentions right now. The conventional wisdom in Israel and among the leadership here is that the great American interest in Israel has been, up till now, at least just keeping things calm here, trying to keep this off the table as an issue, avoiding having it become a distraction from what they're trying to do in Iraq, and also an issue that would further inflame the Arab Muslim world. That's one thing, for example, that the Israelis see as arguing against any move against Yasser Arafat right now, because it would make life so much more difficult for President Bush. At least that's the analysis. Now, the other argument is that that George Bush could use some sort of something he can at least describe as progress here, as evidence of a real move forward. And an Israeli withdrawal for the first time from some of the occupied territories would be a tremendous change here on the ground. Historic. Historic is not too strong a word to apply to that. So both Ariel Sharon and George Bush need something politically, I think, out of this meeting. The problem is that their political interests then begin to diverge. Because President Bush has invested himself in this roadmap peace initiative, when Ariel Sharon originally put forward his unilateral withdrawal plan, he said he was only going to pursue it if he judged that the roadmap had failed. Well, that was a problem for Washington, because they don't want anybody judging that the roadmap has failed. So you've seen a change in the Israeli language about this. Now the unilateral withdrawal plan is becoming a way to actually push forward the roadmap, as somehow they're melding these two plans and trying to figure a way to argue that they're actually consistent with each other. They also, it seems they're also likely to have some different interests in terms of what they want to get out of this. The Israelis want as specific an American commitment as they can get to what Israel's borders might ultimately look like, essentially, in any kind of peace agreement. They want an American commitment to hold on to some West Bank territory. Americans have traditionally resisted prejudging what are known as final status issues, that is, final issues for final talks, like the exact disposition of borders or the status of Palestinian refugees. So the Bush White House is likely to be more interested in some sort of vaguely worded statement and images of great friendship. This meeting is likely to be all smiles on both sides, because they're quite in agreement about what the imagery should be. But in terms of the substance of it, I think they're still trying to bridge this basic gap.
Do you have any idea what Nabil Shaath, the Palestinian foreign minister, will be asking for when he comes to the United States later this month to meet with American officials?
I think that he'll be seeking, above all, I think, some clarity on exactly what this plan is. Palestinian officials have complained to me recently that they just don't have an idea what's going on. They don't really know what Washington is up to, let alone Jerusalem. And they're trying to figure out what the implications of this plan are. Nabil Shaath has also made clear that he's expecting the Palestinians to get a great deal of money out of this deal for redeveloping Gaza.
I'm wondering how the United States occupation of Iraq is looking to you from your seat in Israel, having covered the occupation there for so long.
Well, in some ways, it's looking increasingly familiar, but the similarities can be a little bit deceptive and overly distracting, I think, from the differences. I mean, the fact is that the Americans are not building settlements in Iraq. And there is no disagreement among Americans, I think, over whether they want to stay in Iraq or not, whereas there is a very, very strong political debate in Israel now over whether they want to hold on to these territories or not. But in terms of the kind of military tactics that the Americans are using, in terms of what's happening to the population there, it does look somewhat familiar. And the great parallel that's being drawn here by Israelis and Palestinians is to the Israeli experience in Lebanon, of course. When Ariel Sharon, then defense minister in 1982, sent Israeli troops across the border into Lebanon, at the time supposedly to suppress Palestinian fire over that border from southern Lebanon, the Israelis were initially greeted with open arms by the Shiites, literally greeted with flowers, and their arrival was celebrated. But it wasn't it wasn't long before the guerrilla group Hezbollah was formed, which is still tormenting Israel to this day.
Is there a particular story regarding the United States' experience in Iraq that seemed very familiar to you, having covered Israel?
The incidents that really struck me early a year ago were the incidents at checkpoints in Iraq, when the Americans were struggling somehow to set up checkpoints that would screen dangerous from non-dangerous members of the population. And there were a couple of terrible incidents when Americans were attacked at checkpoints, or when they opened fire on people who turned out to be non-combatants, that reminded me graphically of what it is, the difficulty, the tragedy, in a sense, of these efforts that often are sincerely intended to promote security, but are extremely difficult in practice to carry out without alienating a population, without treating people just terribly.
This might be stretching a point, but as you mentioned, the United States doesn't have settlements in Iraq the way Israel has settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. But, you know, Israel has found it very difficult to withdraw from the territories it occupied. And do you think that there's a parallel there that the United States is or will be facing?
Oh, I don't think that's stretching a point at all. I mean, I think that's a tremendous problem for the Americans now. How do you declare victory and withdraw and have that victory be seen as a victory in the eyes of the world and in the eyes of the Iraqis? One of the problems Ariel Sharon is having right now with his unilateral withdrawal plan is that he, above all Israelis, really has argued that Israel needs to maintain its deterrent policy. That is, it can never afford to give anything up under fire, because that will be seen as a sign of weakness. Israel finally left Lebanon unilaterally in May of 2000 in a great hurry, after 20 years in a great hurry. But it was seen, after 18 years, excuse me, in a great hurry. But it was seen now in Israel as having partly led to the Palestinian Intifada by persuading Palestinians that the only way you convince Israelis to give something up is by fighting them and bleeding them to death, literally. Because so many soldiers were dying every year in Lebanon, the Israelis finally withdrew. That was the lesson the Palestinians drew. The Americans are likely to face a similar problem in Iraq. They don't want to be seen as withdrawing under fire because of the message that could send in Iraq and around the world about what it takes to weaken American resolve. On the other hand, the argument will be made that staying in there longer simply to make this point is not nearly worth the price that's being paid. So in other words, once you get into a situation like this, it can be very, very difficult to find your way out of it.
Miqtada al-Sadr, the radical Shiite cleric whose followers are now rising against the United States, says that he would like to open an Iraqi chapter of Hamas and Hezbollah. Is there any? Do you have any insights into that statement, and if there is a likelihood of any kind of alignment between those groups?
I think a lot of us here were scratching our heads about that statement, trying to figure out exactly what he meant. I mean, does he mean that he's going to create some sort of fundraising arm for them? Is he going to actually recruit Palestinians to function as Hamas gunmen in Iraq attacking Americans? It's not really clear what he means. So the implications of it aren't certain. Saddam Hussein obviously supported Palestinians. He sent money to the families of suicide bombers, $25,000, as much as $25,000. That money has now been cut off. Maybe he's thinking about opening that pipeline again. But it's really not clear what it would mean, what the implications would be for the conflict there or for here. As I said earlier, Hamas has traditionally resisted getting drawn into anything that looked like a direct attack on America, and they say they don't plan to change that strategy.
My guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. One of the biggest stories in the United States is an investigation into what the Bush administration knew about terrorism before September 11th. Did it plan adequately? And also, what did it know about weapons of mass destruction, and why was the intelligence so misleading about Iraq? Now, in late March, in Israel, a parliamentary subcommittee criticized Israel's intelligence services, saying that those agencies overestimated Iraq's weapons programs before the war. Is that a big story in Israel? Is it anything like the bigness of the story here in the United States?
No, it doesn't have nearly the dimensions that it has in the U.S. It was more of a 1 or 2 day story here. The thing is that the Israeli security establishment then and now was really arguing that Iraq wasn't that much of a clear and present danger to Israel, that there was the risk of WMD, that he did have some missiles. But, I just spoke to a senior military official the other day who said, and I was asking him, are Israelis safer now than they were a year ago? And his argument was that Iraq wasn't a threat then either. So his answer to the question really was no. And whether the Israelis would be safer in the long term or not was very much a question of whether the Americans would continue to be the presence in the region that they've now become.
Israel and the United States has despaired that there isn't a more moderate Palestinian leadership to negotiate with, to be peace partners with. Do you see a more, quote, moderate leadership being formed?
No, that is, I don't see a leadership being formed that is in that has the capacity to lead. There certainly are moderate Palestinians, or pragmatic Palestinians, if you prefer the term. Plenty of people who would like to see this conflict end. Plenty of people who would like to see a negotiated agreement and a two-state solution to put this conflict behind them. But at the moment, those voices aren't heard with any authority on the Palestinian side. I want to make clear that, from the Palestinian perspective, it's because of the Israeli occupation and because of Israel's attacks on the Palestinian Authority over the last couple of years that the governing structures have basically crumbled. And the overwhelming Palestinian view of that is that that is the Israeli strategy, that Israel set out under Ariel Sharon,
right.
Israel set out to do away with these with the mainstream moderate voices.
I think a lot of people around the world are so frustrated with the Middle East, it's always a problem. There's never any resolution, and there's never any common ground that seems to last for very long between Israel and the Palestinians. Do you feel that way too, that things just don't change?
My wife and I were talking about this just last night. It's very tempting to feel that way. And even particularly, I think, as a reporter covering the conflict, I find myself falling into that line of thinking, because you go and you cover some event that seems cataclysmic, say a suicide bombing, and you interview the victims and the families and or some sort of incursion into the Palestinian areas that results in a large number of dead, including civilians, and you talk to the families, and you just feel that something has to happen. This has to change, that this is so awful, that what these people are suffering is so terrible, that something has to happen, and then it doesn't. And so you kind of are lulled, or lulled is the wrong word, but disappointed into this sense that as bad as it gets, nothing really does happen. But it's just not true. I think right now is a time of tremendous change here. The world is focused on other problems elsewhere, but there is a tremendous amount happening on the ground here and ideologically on both sides. This unilateral withdrawal plan has had big political consequences in the debate inside Israel now. There's broad consensus about the idea of some sort of Palestinian state down the road, some sort of Israel retreat from the territories, which would have been unheard of even just a few years ago. At the same time, the building of this barrier is a tremendous change on the ground. It's having, again, political repercussions, I think, beyond what anybody's really anticipated. It's likely to become some sort of de facto boundary. settlers are saying that settlement prices on one side of the wall are dropping relative to those on the other, which suggests some sort of market calculation about what ultimately is going to be part of Israel and what is not. And on the Palestinian side, the chaos in the territories, the collapse of any sort of leadership, the disintegration of the pragmatic voices, and the growth of this culture of suicide bombing and martyrdom among the young is also a tremendous change. So things are changing here. It doesn't necessarily mean they're moving towards a resolution, but there's a lot going on.
Well, James Bennett, I want to thank you so much for talking with us, and I wish you safe travels.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks very much.
James Bennett is the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. Our interview was recorded this morning. And speaking of the Times, Times Square got its name 100 years ago today. It was named for the headquarters of the New York Times building that was being constructed between Broadway and 7th Avenue and 42nd and 43rd Streets. We'll close with the title song from the 1933 movie 42nd Street.
That runs into Times Square. A crazy quilt that Wall Street Jack built. If you've got a little time to spare, I'd like to take you there. Come and meet those dancing feet. On the avenue I'm taking you to, 42nd Street. Hear the beat of dancing feet. It's a song I love, the melody of 42nd Street. Little nifties from the 50s, innocent and sweet. Sexy ladies from the 80s who are indiscreet. All the side by side, they're glorified. Where the underworld can meet the elite, 42nd Street.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Aveda, an earth-conscious beauty company committed to preserving natural resources and finding more sustainable ways of doing business. Information available at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
William Taubman's biography of Nikita Khrushchev won a Pulitzer Prize this week. On the next Fresh Air, Taubman talks about the Russian ruler who led the Soviet Union after Stalin's death and attempted to de-Stalinize it. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.